Between the Lines with Andrea Gilligan. This is News Talk.
Hello, you're very welcome along to News Talks Between the Lines. This is the programme where we take a closer look at some of the main stories and issues of interest. I'm Richard Chambers, sitting in for Andrea this week. Today we're examining the emotive issue of Ireland's tradition and its policy of neutrality. A lot of column inches have been spent on Ireland's involvement in the EU's Permanent Structured Cooperation, or PESCO, and how this week's past expulsion of a Russian diplomat affects our neutrality. Joining us on this morning's panel, Deirdre Clune, Fine Gael MEP for Ireland South, Richard Boyd-Barrett, People Before Profit TD for Dunleary, Shona Murray, Foreign Affairs Correspondent with the Irish Independent, and Declan Power, former Army officer and security analyst. You're all very welcome to the programme. Just to start off, Declan, this idea of PESCO, because it has been a major talking point over the last number of weeks and months, and people will say, well, it's the start of a European army and it has this and that and it's very vague. What exactly is PESCO?
Well, it's important people understand that PESCO isn't an alliance. It's been referred to as such at times in recent fora and discussion about it. PESCO is designed as a mechanism that allows different European countries, not just European Union countries, but countries that maybe have similar interests in security and defence, to come together, to cluster together, either to get funding maybe from the European Defence Agency for a project, or to share the spending on something like, I think the Dutch and Belgians were going to purchase a hospital ship together, something along those lines. And from our point of view, it allows us to set the terms by which we want to get involved in it, because there's a little bit of confusion. It's not NATO. So, I heard somebody recently say, oh, 2% of our GDP would now have to be spent on defence. Well, that's only if we decided we wanted to spend that. At the moment, we spend 0.03% on our defence. And if we note down in our arrangements for PESCO that we're only going to spend 0.03%, or we're going to move it up to 0.04%, well, then that's what the European Union will hold us to. In other words, you set the terms by which you're going to get involved in this, and you're expected to adhere to them, which is quite different from any other system. So the other aspect of PESCO is it is to allow cooperation between clusters of states where they have maybe particular defence needs, like the Scandinavians and Finland. They have particular defence needs that are unique to them. And it would allow us, even post-Brexit, have arrangements, or to refine arrangements that we have with the UK in terms of security and defence in the islands. And it puts things on an even keel. It doesn't change the arrangement. The European Union, we should be clear on this, it looks to, or would have arrangements with NATO when it comes to heavy lifting in terms of military affairs or military support. So from our point of view, we're not being sucked into that. The European Union has these various arrangements, and the different countries will get involved in what they want to get involved in. And that's, now, I just want to hasten that, that's the factuality behind it. It's not just my personal opinion.
Okay, Richard Boyd-Barrett, that all seems wholly sensible in this uncertain time that we would pool together some resources.
Declan has done an excellent job in sanitising the and then claiming
it. Thank you, Richard. Please indeed.
Claiming it, to a fine
and
start.
Claiming it as facts. It's fascinating. But actually, the facts are, first of all, that Federica Mogherini, Donald Tusk, and other very senior people in the European Union have described it as a common defence, okay, or moving towards a common defence.
Moving towards, I think.
I'm not for moving towards a common defence, Declan.
Fair enough, Richard, fair enough.
So to my mind, it is the slippery slope. It is part of the evolution of a European army, creating, if you like, the infrastructure, the backup infrastructure for a European army. There are, in fact, although the specific projects, Declan is right to say, you can opt in and opt out of, there are about 20 binding commitments which we have now signed up to, which are very serious indeed. And they include, for example, that the military budgets in all of the signatory countries have to be monitored on an annual basis by this new European structure, which will now have a headquarters. It is, in effect, the headquarters of a new European army.
There already is, though, a headquarters, Richard.
Yeah, and now we're signed up to it. And we are now going to be monitored, and our budgets are going to be monitored, and we will be required to increase our military spending on a progressive basis So we're no longer fully in control of our own budgets. And so the more money will be spent on arms. We're also, it is a requirement of this that you have sort of full interoperability with NATO. Declan says, oh, sure, that's, you know, there's nothing to that. Nothing to interoperability.
No, I agree.
NATO, that's standardisation.
Sean O'Murray.
I'm not for standardising with NATO.
Richard Sean O'Murray.
No, but that's standardisation in the sense of not standardising so we're going to get F-16s and fighter jets. It's about standardising our military when we engage in legal UN mandated missions like Chapter 6, Chapter 7, peace enforcement, peacekeeping missions, so that when we do, because we have such a small army, when we do tie in with other groups like the...
There's no reference to the United Nations anywhere in the PESCO agreement. Nowhere.
But Richard, our constitutionally and legally, we can only ever engage when we have the triple lock system and when something's UN mandated. PESCO is separate to that. It's standardisation so that when we do work with other armies like the Fijians in Lebanon, for example, that we have the same methodology, that we know that we're using the same sort of armor, guns, defense systems. That's
command
what that's about. It's not exactly. It's not about purchasing aggressive, belligerent weapons.
Okay, I do want to come to Deirdre Clune on this.
It's about, as Shona said, it's about, I mean, we have to keep our army, Declan, you know more about this, but they came up to date with equipment and training and that, and PESCO is about, you know, it allows us, and it was passed by the Oireachtas, or the Dáil, so it allows us to participate.
Why was that, that we passed that without much of a public debate on this? Because in Malta and in Denmark, they've been allowed to opt out of this, that they're going to monitor it, because, especially in the Maltese case, they want to see how it would affect their neutrality. Why did we sign up to this before we had that same discussion?
We felt that this is it's not, you don't have to opt in, it's an opt-in, opt-out, as we please. In fact, I think it was last month that we agreed to participate in two type of missions. One was Garda training, and another was maritime surveillance. So it's already an operation since the end of last month, I think. Mm. So, you know, it's just about allowing us to participate and benefit from the training and the information that's available, and getting our securities, our defence forces, relatively equipped and able to participate should we want to. And I mean, it's not about a European army or anything. Europe is actually moving. Yes, that's right. It's not a new army. It's a completely different thing.
Is it not deliberately vague in a way? And it does. If you look at the reporting in it from the German media in particular and the French media as well, it is being framed as a step towards a common defence and a European army.
PESCO isn't, but Europe is moving towards a common
defence. Richard,
there's
a particular point. I just want to expand on a couple of things that Deirdre has brought in, and also that the other two speakers raised. First of all, we tend to fixate about these arrangements from a purely military point of view when we're discussing them. I've worked on a number of different European Union missions, so and based on that experience, I can tell you one. The EU focuses a lot more on the soft power aspects. And these arrangements allow for, as Deirdre said, maritime surveillance issues, stuff that it goes outside the purview of normal military operations. And there's a range of things the European Union have been doing and funding in different parts of the world to counter extremism and terrorism and things like that with developing countries. And it allows for countries like ours to come together with other countries and be interoperable to do training for African militaries and African police. The European Union training mission for the Somalian military, which was run out of Uganda for a number of years, it's to further enhance that. Now, it's important to be aware that, despite Richard's misgivings, it's right and proper we discuss this, it is only Ireland that can increase the defence budget under these PESCO arrangements. And given our history, I can't see us developing it much more. I don't see us doing that. We're not a war-fighting nation. The second thing is, Shauna's point of view about interoperability is entirely correct, except for one additional thing. We've already done that. The White Paper on Defence has already laid out the fact that we have to be interoperable. And the reason for that is not to compromise our independence of choice, but that when we do elect to send our forces overseas, that they're able to take to the field in a way that they can cooperate and conjoin, that there is the right level of command and control. Otherwise, you're putting people in harm's way without the means to protect themselves. And not to sound, facile, but would we expect the Dublin team to take to the pitch in all Ireland Ireland Day without having trained together. I mean, you're asking troops to go into complex emergency situations with a whole variety of things now that military forces have to be able to do, including engage with humanitarians to be able to protect the space properly they operate in. And if they don't train, there's an exercise coming up now this month, a European exercise called Exercise Viking. The Swedes run it. We've participated in it for a number of years. I've instructed on it over a number of years. It's military, civilian, it's interoperability training for everybody. Now, okay. If we don't do those kind of things, we're not going to be able to do the job.
Richard Boyd Barrett, you've been very patient there and you've been waiting to come back in.
I'm such a patient person. you see, Declan is trying to turn this into a technical debate, and it's not a technical debate. He's right to say that in treaties that we've signed up to, we've already moved in a very significant degree, and that's why I opposed those treaties, was because, in fact, we signed up to a Lisbon treaty that included interoperability with NATO, progressive upgrading of military capabilities, and also coming to the aid of other member states in the event that, and this is where it's very relevant to what happened with Russia, this
solidarity.
Coming to the aid of other EU states who are the victims of, terror, right? Mm. And, of course, as we know, terror and the fight against terror was the primary justification used for the invasion of Iraq. It was a preemptive fight against terror. Okay. It turned out not to be a fight against terror, but a fight based on a fantasy and a lie about weapons of mass destruction. But it's very important to say terror and opposing terror was the justification for that disastrous war. Also, it is critical to understand that Ireland's international reputation and its ability to go into places like Lebanon, Syria, North Africa, and so on, is precisely because we are seen as non-aligned. Mm-hmm. Yep. When we align closer to European military structures in any shape or form that are dominated by major imperial powers with a history...
Do you actually believe, though, Richard Boyd Barrett, that this is eventually going to end up, but that PESCO is the first step to Irish soldiers serving under, you know, the blue flag of the EU in some European army?
I mean, we already have served under the blue flag.
Yeah, so in terms of a European army, Declan. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, just to clarify a couple of things, because that's the problem. I take Richard's point about, and I'm perfectly happy to broaden the discussion on this and not be too technical. But we have, and we do serve under the blue flag of the United Nations, of the EU, and indeed NATO. If you look at an Irish soldier on parade today at the chest of medals that they wear, comparatively young men with an awful lot of medals, because we've been on a lot of different missions. We've been on three of those missions, but it's under certain criteria that suit this country, what are known as the St. Petersburg tasks, which are to do with crisis management and peacekeeping. Now, everybody's raised this question, and I suppose I should address it because I've kind of fudged around it a bit, which is the European army thing. Mm. I don't want to see a European army.
I don't think...
And no military person I know. And you know, part of the reason is because we know it won't work. Those of us who have been engaged in operations involving the EU, it's such a complex cluster of nations to try and get anything done. I mean, there's been a number of nations that were in Afghanistan in some shape or form, including our own, under the triple lock, small amounts of personnel for intelligence-related and force protection and bomb disposal work and training. But the issue here is to try and bring together such a disparate group of nations, PESCO is allowing them to come together as it suits them and under certain levels. Now, it is definitely true, Richard's point, the French and the Germans would, particularly the French, like to see this federalised Europe. But there's clusters. The Scandinavians don't. And we're, the Finns and the Swedes, who also signed up to PESCO, who have very similar foreign policy.
Yeah, just on this point, I mean, what Declan is explaining there is different to what we're hearing when we hear from critics of PESCO. I mean, has the government and the EU done a good enough job of explaining exactly what this is?
Because PESCO is about countries coming together. It's collaboration and on issues that where we feel we want to contribute and we can contribute, and that's important. It's important in phase. I mean, it's not about military threats or dealing with military threats. Now, I mean, you've got so many things, as Declan has mentioned, Africa, dealing with Africa, migrants, the situation in the Mediterranean, our Navy personnel there cooperating under Operation Sophia. I mean, that is something that we're very proud of and we want to contribute to. And there will be issues like that, such as peacekeeping missions, humanitarian missions, rescue missions. And we have to, I mean, the best option for us as a country is to participate with other countries, and we can collaborate together and work together and avail of the expertise that we don't have. But certainly, as Declan has pointed out, it's quite obvious when we've sent out troops or guard the personnel to areas to participate, they need to be trained and they need to be able to slot in and have the same standards as others.
Okay.
And actually,
I'm in a minority of one on this panel who are clearly but no, nonetheless,
I'm not sure a minority.
I think we're all one on the European army with you as well.
Fine Gael MEPs just produced a paper where they essentially said we should move away from neutrality. PESCO, by the way, one of the very important points is PESCO specifically says that there should be a review of national decision-making processes, okay? Now, that's a reference to the triple lock in our case, right, which is a safeguard that was essentially forced on previous governments because of the opposition to any move away from neutrality. So that's very worrying. And when you connect that to what happened this week, you start to get deeply worried, okay? Because alignment with a common defence isn't just about the deployment of military personnel. It's also about political alignment. That's how it starts. And we've had a very, very good example of it this week where we have two major power blocks, the US-European axis and the Russian axis, now confronting each other in a very serious way on a global level in the Middle East, in Central Europe, and then it's even starting to get played out in Europe as we saw, right? For us to align ourselves, as we basically did this week, and it was all justified on the basis of these are our EU partners, therefore we have to act in solidarity with them, even if we have no tangible evidence, we're going to act with them. Why? Because we're their EU partners. And then we become identified with that bloc politically. So our
we've always been identified with the bloc. We are so far involved with the European Union since 1973.
Neutrality means neutrality.
But hold on a minute. You're talking about a political decision based on intelligence evidence. That's separate. First of all, back to your point, when we had that solidarity part in the Lisbon Treaty, what has changed since the Lisbon Treaty in the way that we haven't been able to go to places like Lebanon and Mali and our troops haven't been accepted as peacekeeping troops? Nothing.
Oh no, something big has changed this week.
No, sorry, Richard, but this is what you warned when we signed off on the Lisbon Treaty, and none of that has happened. We will always have the same history when it comes to we don't have a colonial past, that we have that we're non-formally aligned, that our troops are welcomed by people because they're peacekeeping troops. The what happened this week in Russia is it would be naive for you to think that just because we're non-formally aligned that Russia won't impact on us. And also without knowing the type of intelligence that was garnered from Salisbury, the intelligence that is known from the French, the British, to turn around and say, oh, we need to question that even more and therefore not expel, not do anything to Russia. Do you think that Russia is not a belligerent threat to the future of Europe, to the future of the West? Is that what you're saying?
Well, seeing as you're asking me the question, can I answer?
you can answer. I do want to focus in on the Russian experience.
Sorry, one other second. I covered the case of Mouad el-Mabou when he was assassinated using Irish passports in Dubai in 2010. You were the first person who wanted the Israelis thrown out of Ireland because of that. And that's what happened. You know what? The intelligence was correct. The Mossad did assassinate, use an extrajudicial killing. They did target Hamas militants. I was in Gaza at the time. And they got the right guy because their intelligence was correct. And what did the Irish government do? We expelled an Israeli diplomat. Yeah. That's something
it's okay
for the Israelis, but not the Russians.
It's not difficult when the passport that is used is on Pembroke Road and the Israeli embassy is just around the corner to figure it out.
I just want to hear this. We have to take a break.
But there's a technical point here.
Absolutely. What I said in the Dáil very clearly this week is that we should be consistent. And in fact, last week, we had called on the government to call the Russian ambassador in over the horrific actions of Russia in Syria. And Russia should absolutely be called out because there we know chemical weapons were used by an alliance of Russia and Syria. When myself and Gino Kenny put that point to the government, completely ignored us. Completely ignored us. They weren't interested in any action, even calling the Russian ambassador in.
You're right about that, double standards.
Total double standards. So that begs the question, why did they move so quickly this week?
Well, the first thing is that with regards to the proofs of kicking out diplomats, I believe actually we had more proof in as much as we had it this time than we had on previous occasions. Because on the previous occasions, both the Israeli diplomat and the Russian diplomat, we relied virtually completely. People said, actually a colleague of yours, Breed, made the point, Breed Smith, the other night when I was talking to her, that there was a complete investigation by the Gardaí with regards to the Israeli issue. It's never been actually proved in the way that people talk about it that the Israelis did clone our passports. Like, we all accept it, but it has never been fully proved. Nobody's been able to have a direct link, nor with the Russian diplomat who was kicked out over the passports being misused in the States and a Russian spying mission. So you're never going to get the level of proof that you would use in a courtroom. In this occasion, it was a mixture of reporting and that has been going on for some time to the government from J2 of the Defence Forces and CSB of the Gardaí about Russian activities here and elsewhere. Now, take that for a second and just park it. I want to come back to the point about what Richard was saying about, you know, he's for neutrality. And you know what? One thing I admire about Richard Boyd Barrett is that you have always been consistent, and you were consistent about calling out the Russians about their inhumanity in Syria. But we have been consistent too in this country, in that if you look at our definition and our concept of neutrality in this country, it is different to what Richard is talking about. We do not have, and we never have had, that kind of neutrality. That's a fact. I mean, you look back to the Second World War, we now know, and the books have been written, read Eoin Ó Halpin's books on defending Ireland, the Irish state and its enemies, and that Ireland was very much in cooperation with the Allies in a way that if it was 5 years forward or 10 years forward with modern communications, we wouldn't have been able to stay out of that war. Like it or lump it, we are a small, interdependent or even codependent nation. If we wanted to be as neutral to the point that Richard and some of his colleagues would suggest, fine, but then we would have to develop the apparatus, the military apparatus, that we're not prepared to do. Yeah. And just my final point in this area. The second thing is, we're not prepared to do that. So therefore, if we don't have some sort of a conjoined apparatus to share intelligence, to share defence of our skies, as we now know that we'll call the RAF, call on the RAF to do that, and various other things, if we're not, our whole defence posture has been predicated by reliance on external partners since the foundation of this state. So, you know, it's one or the other. And we have gone that direction.
I agree with a lot of that because, you know, as I said, our neutrality has been pragmatic, if you like, in some cases, and it's been flexible. And you mentioned Fine Gael MEPs. We produced a document recently, a discussion document, and we said really we need to look at this issue of neutrality. We're not saying we shouldn't. We don't want to be military aligned, but in the faces of all these threats and challenges that are out there now, cybersecurity, terrorism, we can't be isolated. We absolutely need to plug in to other countries, and that's our EU partners, and we need to benefit from their knowledge and their intelligence to protect our citizens, and that's what it's about.
Just with regards to, sorry, Sean, I want to actually, just on this point, with regards to the Russian situation, because a lot of people really aren't focusing in on, you know, what it actually means from an Irish standpoint. I mean, is Ireland really a dispassionate bystander in this? Or we are actually affected with regards to Russian military actions, especially with, you know, regard to, you know, buzzing UK military aircraft as well. I mean, we're not exactly fully out of the picture
here. No, of course we're not. But directly or indirectly, because we know that there's been cyber attacks on, like, the HSC. Mm. We know there's been cyber attacks in banks, also in countries like Estonia. We know that Brexit directly affects us, and we know that there was Russian interference in Brexit. We know that America directly affects us. Western culture, you know, fake news, those sort of attacks affect us directly. And of course we're targeted and involved in that. Second of all, on the issue, what are you laughing at, Richard? I mean, that's just reality.
The Russians are coming.
No, they're not coming.
You
can't put your head in the sand. You know, we need
The second part of that is we rely on everybody else to protect us. You had, and one of the things I wanted to say about specifically on Ireland relying on everyone else, is I remember Obama, when he left office, he wrote this thing called the Obama Doctrine. It was about his foreign policy. And one of the things he said he disregarded was coattails, people who were on the coattails of America. You have international coalitions targeting groups like the Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria, and we expect to be protected from those groups, yet we don't join into any of those missions, but yet we could easily be targeted by ISIS. Maybe not so much now. So of course Ireland is going to could be targeted or could have an impact on us, whether it's through cybersecurity or any of those elements.
Okay, Richard Boy Barrett, I mean, you interjected there with this thing that it's becoming, the Russians are coming, reds under the bed, all that sort of thing. But with regard to Russia as it stands and the Putin administration, if you want to call it administration or you want to call it regime or whatever, and the actions that they've taken, whether it's in Syria, it's in Chechnya, and it's their intervention in the sovereign affairs of European nations, are we not right to take a stand on it? We're never going to be fully neutral. We signed up to the EU and our EU neighbours are being interfered with in some regard, whether that's the Baltic states or it's Sweden or it's in the democratic process in the UK. We should surely take a stand alongside them.
You see, I have the benefit of being consistent. I actually protested against what the Russians did in Chechnya when the political establishment in the West were absolutely silent. They didn't give a damn about what happened in Chechnya. So it's a bit rich, frankly, for people who are now saying we need to take action and worry about the Russians, that they said nothing when the Chechens were being eviscerated by the Russians. So do I think Putin is an authoritarian, dangerous warmonger, an extreme nationalist, anti-LGBT, totally undemocratic? I absolutely do. Do I think Donald Trump is an authoritarian, dangerous, warmonger, anti-LGBT threat? I think he is, okay? Because one of the absolute central pillars of Trump's campaign was to massively ramp up military expenditure in the area of nuclear, the US nuclear arsenal, which he's planning to spend, I think, an extra trillion over the next few years on the nuclear arsenal. He threatened to use nuclear weapons in the North Korean standoff. To my mind, we've got two very dangerous, volatile blocks, which is the US block, which Europe now wants to align itself, and you have Russia. And what that plays out as...
I just don't have a point.
No, I haven't finished.
Okay.
And this disaster has already played out in Syria, where both sides were backing awful forces, right? Were the Russians backing awful forces in Assad? Absolutely. Were the Americans backing Al-Qaeda via Saudi Arabia? Absolutely.
Yeah,
so
right.
Should we align with either of these two blocks? No. Neutrality means we don't
But there's a point there that Richard made that that he's correct about, but, and this is an important consideration. Yeah, what you said about Syria and Saudi and how they behave is absolutely correct. But you know, I believe that the Saudi or the Syrian situation would probably be stalled had Russia not gotten a free hand. In other words, what you're saying about your criticisms of the states, I think, are slightly, you know, you're kind of letting maybe your natural emotion engage here. No, but what I'm saying here is I don't think the states are interested in getting involved in things the way they used to. And exact this opposite, retreat from the world stage has led Russia to become emboldened, step into Syria. They stepped into Syria at a time where both sides were nearly exhausted and there would be a peace deal. Syria would be fragmented but be a lot less debts because of the lack of US engagement. And what Europe did last week is because there has been a widening gap. Trump is pulling away from international engagement in certain areas. If it's not that he's warmongering as much, it's that he's becoming isolationist, which is just as dangerous.
Except for supporting Israel.
Yeah, no,
hold on a second.
Or Saudi.
Yeah,
well, Saudi.
No, but exactly, just to finish the point, Europe took a stance that was not militarily belligerent. It was using diplomatic instruments. And I would have thought you'd welcome that. And it wasn't relying on the US. The US were playing catch up. Trump didn't lead on this. And that's the lesson is we can't rely on the US to be the world's policeman in the way we used to, and we in Europe have to make our own arrangements.
Exactly,
Sean
O'Malley, I think that's
sorry,
really, that's
sorry,
exactly
Sean
right.
Point
we
you're
can't making. Use the United States is no longer a reliable partner, or hasn't been actually, I think, since the Iraq War, because we had not the majority, I don't think, of EU member states supported the Iraq War because they knew that the intelligence was faulty. But I think what happened with us supporting the strong statement was actually saving the multilateral system, because Trump has pulled away from it. You have been employing people like John Bolton, who has nothing but disdain for multilateralism and the United Nations. So at least you had a 28-member bloc saying, first of all, we're all threatened by Vladimir Putin. Second of all, we do this in a diplomatic way. And thirdly, because, I mean, and definitely from an Irish perspective, it was in the national interest, because it was about saying to the UK, we stand behind you in spite of the terrible Anglo-Irish relations that exist right now. And it was a show of, look, aren't you better off within the EU as a 28-member bloc than outside it? So there was an element of that as well. But again, it's about saying, look, we can do this through diplomatic means, having discussions. Yes, you expel a diplomat, but not all you don't end diplomatic relations. And by the way, we also do know that that was probably a lot of a show, because, I mean, look at Germany and Russia have incredible relations with each other, yeah. Commercial ties you had. And also what I thought was really, really good about this was the clamour to support multilateralism. Even people like Alexis Tsipras in Greece, who on the day spoke to Vladimir Putin and said, we need to have more Greek-Russian relations. So that's what it was about. And I don't understand why you can't stand behind that, Richard.
I once come to Deirdre Clune.
Greece didn't expel a diplomat.
Deirdre Clune was about this. And the gesture of expelling a diplomat, was it just purely symbolic in a way?
No, I think it was, as Sean has said, it was European countries working together, and indeed internationally as well. And I'm thinking of a statement Angela Merkel made last year when she said no longer can we depend on the US, and that's why there has been movements at European level to coordinate areas such as defence and in a diplomatic fashion as well. And I think we should all kind of pay more attention to what's going on in Europe, and because it is moving fast and the debate is moving there, and we need to be part of it. But no, I think you know what we saw this week was, yes, Ireland standing in solidarity with the UK, but then the fact that there were so many countries moved so quickly, I think it was unprecedented from what I'm reading, it was unprecedented the way the UK shared intelligence that they don't normally do. They normally reserve it for the higher edge, or those that they can trust more because Theresa May was on a run.
She wanted this and they moved
pretty quickly, and whatever. I mean I don't think that information should be shared publicly, but whatever it was, everybody signed up pretty quickly and said this is, you know. And I see it every day, like the countries in the Baltic states, Latvia in particular, they are really worried about Russia, the cyber, their Polish, and Finland in particular as well. There's tanks on their border, Russian tanks,
Sweden
looking across,
has reoccupied Gotland Island.
So there is a real concern in Europe about what's happening on the eastern border.
I'm conscious that Richard Boyd-Barrett cuts a fairly lowly figure in studio at this point. I mean, just with regard to everything that's happening.
But not in Irish society.
That is the point. I mean, that's a good point.
Not in Irish society. Okay.
Just with regard to everything that's happened and the expulsion of diplomats, and you and other TDs were calling for, if there is evidence, let's see it. Yeah. But that traditionally wouldn't happen with sensitive information like this. I mean, it is an unrealistic demand that here, if this is something which is, you know, has Russian involvement in it, they're not going to come out and show their whole hand.
Listen, I went to a supposedly high-level briefing with Simon Coveney, who apparently has seen the evidence, and he said directly to us at that, there is no smoking gun. Okay? Not, I can't tell you about the smoking gun. He said, there is no smoking gun. So what we have is supposition without investigation. And it's fairly obvious, isn't it? You can't do an investigation of this that quickly. So it was a political decision was made. Now, I do not believe we should adopt a threshold of this is the most plausible explanation, therefore it's true, right? If we applied that to cases of criminality, we'd be in serious trouble, right?
It wouldn't stand up in court.
Absolutely. So I don't believe we should engage in diplomatic warfare, because that's what it is, with Russia, because that is a stepping stone to an escalating confrontation, which could, and it could escalate. I don't know if it's going to escalate, but it could escalate. And secondly, as an independent, neutral country, I believe we need to be even-handed. In other words, if we're going to expel diplomats, because let's say the Russians are guilty and we do find evidence and there was a smoking gun, yes, should they be expelled? Yes, actually they probably should have been expelled a few weeks ago over what they did in Syria. Mm-hmm. They probably should be expelled over their treatment of LGBT people. But equally, I want to see expulsions of Israeli diplomats over what they're doing to the Palestinians. Will there be expulsions of Israeli diplomats by the European Union? Guaranteed. It won't happen.
We already have.
Sorry, Sean.
The idea of expelling the Russian diplomat is also based on the fact that we had our own investigation into possible spying,
No,
what I'm saying is the impact on Ireland is direct, and we are a member of an EU 28 bloc. So we'd make those decisions based on solidarity, based on, as I said, diplomacy, multilateralism. I agree with you in relation to the Palestinian territories, but the place for that is, you know, the International Criminal Court, where the Palestinians are a member.
We go to court for that, but not for the Russians.
What I'm saying to you is, you're talking about breaches of different types of law. You're talking about about the Geneva Conventions, which apply in the Palestinian territories. But you can't then, therefore, expel a diplomat every time a belligerent state does something wrong.
Why
is
not?
That what you're saying? Then?
Why not?
So then we just cut off relations everywhere.
Well, we start acting unilateral.
You know, with everybody.
Yeah. Either you have a consistent set of ethical foreign policy principles, or you don't. Right?
And
it's clear what you're arguing is.
We
have a different set of principles for the European Union and our interactions with the European Union and its problems than we have for the rest of the world.
It's based on escalation.
You make decisions based on imminence and based on how you as a...
Well,
that was an imminent threat from Russia after Salisbury.
So if it happens in Britain, if there's wrong things done in Britain, we should have a different response than if there's wrong things done
Hold on a second. Yeah, actually, that's the point.
Principles
are fine and there's nothing wrong with... good for you and we all have principles. Statecraft is about... it's about pragmatism, whether we like it or not. And there's no point in asking the Irish state to adhere to a set of principles that no other state in the history of this planet has ever done. That's unrealistic. Now, there's a number of interesting points you raised. I don't want to get into an argument with you about foreign policy ethics, because we'd be here till the cows come home. The point is, we know where you stand on that, and I respect your stance on that. I just don't think it's pragmatic or realistic. We can achieve more multilaterally. We have achieved more, rather than turning ourselves into a little isolated backwater. We saw what this country was like at the end of the Second World War, and we see what it's like now in terms of our influence.
Okay.
Now, here's the point. The point is comes back to what Richard said about intelligence and Simon Coveney. I think some good was done this week in that we have shone a light on our own national security situation and the lack of joined up thinking that's there. And Richard and many of his colleagues have derided the level of intelligence information. And they're right, perhaps, with regards to this, because we don't have a system in this country of a more open system in how we handle national security and intelligence. I would welcome a move in the direction where there is more of an interwoven relationship between Crime and Security Branch, J2, and the National Cybersecurity Unit. And what I would like to see then is more political oversight. We don't have a joint intelligence committee like exists in other places. Just let me finish the point, because Richard made a very valid point. So we would have, when we have another crisis, that there is a system by which the intelligence is brought to government, bearing in mind the need for operational security, and that information then can be presented to a committee, and there's clear lines laid down in how this would be done. So that committee can get direct access to it, but in a way that doesn't compromise operational security.
Deirdre, how do we do that in a way which we don't compromise the idea of neutrality? I mean, what does it actually mean to be neutral in the modern era?
Well, I think, first of all, you've probably to do is look at protecting our citizens and protecting European citizens. And that means dealing with intelligence and sharing intelligence. And that's very important. I think we need those structures to be put in place. We don't have them at the moment. We don't have an overarching intelligence system here in this country. And we need to coordinate that. And we also need to be able to lock into what's happening at European level. I think that's very important. We saw, for instance, the terrorism attacks the attacks in Paris, that there was a Belgian, a European living in Belgium, travelled to Paris, and he had been training in Syria, that information was known to the Belgians, but there was no means of sharing that information with the French. So that comes down to trust, and trust is going to be very important. But we need to do it because of the threat of terrorism, particularly, and we're not isolated from that. I mean, Irish citizens travel every day of the week. We've seen London, we've seen Manchester, which are very close to us, and also the whole area of cyber security as well. That needs to happen. So we need to work together with our European partners, and those structures are being established. We need to be part of it.
Richard Boyd-Barrett, then, on that point and sharing intelligence to make sure that as many people are as protected as possible on this, I mean, do we have to increase our own spending then on intelligence then to sort of look after ourselves and watch our own back in this regard without falling into either camp with regard to Russia, US or whatever sort of thing you want to put.
See, the problem is, who do you share your intelligence with? And all of this is leaning towards this idea that we have to get into some cooperative arrangement with...
We already are, though, Richard.
Richard Woodward.
Sorry, I do not believe we should align with powers that have an agenda, right? And as far as I'm concerned, the French, the Germans, the British, the Spanish, for that matter, all have agendas, right? And I don't think we should be associated with agendas. And the best way...
But then we should leave the EU,
Richard Boyd Rowe.
The best way to protect ourselves against possible attacks is to maintain our reputation, which is a very good reputation in places like the Middle East and Africa and across the world, as a neutral power, as a power as a state which developed precisely in opposition to big powers. Okay, so that is why we have a strong reputation. You go to the Middle East, the people in the Middle East trust the Irish. And it is precisely because of our anti-imperial history and the fact that we are not seen as aligned. It predates even our peacekeeping.
But the reason our peacekeepers
can go to Lebanon and win the trust of people in Lebanon is precisely because of a reputation that predates the deployment of our troops.
But I said that
and
earlier,
we should
Richard.
Not spoil that reputation by aligning.
I literally said that earlier, which means that joining the EU didn't... spoil that, which means the Lisbon Treaty didn't spoil that. And ever since then, we have troops under UNIFIL in Lebanon right now. So what's the problem when we talk about PESCO specifically? You mentioned it earlier, Deirdre. Part of what we do with PESCO is supporting the naval ships in the Mediterranean, help saving lives. So in what way does that spoil the great relations we have?
35,000 dead in the Mediterranean, drowned because Europe wants to keep them out.
What are our naval vessels doing? They're literally saving lives, and they're engaging, and they can do it through a structured way through PESCO.
Sorry, can I kick back in just as somebody who has been in an organisation that has done the peacekeeping, that has put the boots on the ground, can I just say something? And I think it's important. It often gets thrown into debates here, and we forget. We think we're the only ones who do this. There are a number of other countries that have reputations as equal as ours, maybe better in some ways, and they are members of different types of alliances. There are countries. I remember Belgium actually.
The Belgians wouldn't be the greatest example.
Well,
they haven't got the greatest history.
Parts of Africa, they wouldn't be too hard.
That's partially my point. All of these different countries, have had different checkered histories, okay? And they're doing peacekeeping. The Belgians at one point issued an arrest warrant for one of the Israeli political leaders, I forget which one, on the basis if he passed through their space, they had considered him culpable of certain crimes against humanity.
And the Spanish did it as well. The Spanish do use universal jurisdiction quite frequently. I think it might have been Netanyahu.
I think it was. Yeah. And the point, that's the point I'm getting at. That's the point I'm saying. There are other countries who have done things good, done things bad, and it hasn't interfered with their ability to go on UN peacekeeping missions. Remember, we go on UN-led peacekeeping missions, NATO-led peacekeeping missions, EU-led peacekeeping missions. Once they have a UN mandate, we can go on them. Now, just to come back to a point, because Richard was saying some very interesting things. We have to take into account where we are. There's where you would like to be. But when you talk about it, you talk about it as if it's sounding like that we're losing X, Y, and Z. We're a multilateral country. We have already engaged. The relationships are already established with those countries that you're deriding. And you're talking about how we look. Like, I've been in various places where they don't really pay much attention to the fact that I'm Irish. They don't give us the credibility that you're talking about. We're part of an EU mission or we're part of whatever multinational mission. And how does it look? Just take this into account. There's a massive parade of Irishness down New York every year on 17th of March. There are these hugely symbolic things about our relationship with the US, our relationship with other countries. If we were to try and achieve, I just don't think what Richard is talking about is in any way achievable. I think the boat has sailed. It's a redundant argument.
We are seen as very much aligned with the West anyway. I mean,
We have picked a side a long time ago on our terms. Well, that's essentially what
Richard
I'm saying.
Yeah, first of all, it is true that our neutrality has been chipped away at progressively, going right back to the Vietnam War, and we have played indeed to the Second World War. We have quietly backed the Western side. I don't think we should have. But I think the political establishment has always had difficulty in trying to fully align because of the opposition of the majority of the population, whose notion of neutrality is essentially derives from the Irish Revolution, to put it bluntly, right? Yeah. Now, they want to chip away at that and align us. I think that would be a grave mistake and would actually endanger our troops and our international reputation. Because I lived, for example, for a year in the Middle East, okay? Our reputation in the Middle East is amazing. Right, and it is the
still is
okay. You've made that that point, Sean. But
it is because of our anti-colonial history.
Yes, we Richard know, Boy, Sean Murray,
just
your
final thoughts.
There's
48
soldiers that are dead from various bullets, from various munitions. Just to make the point here that, you know, neutrality and these finely crafted words, you know, they're not going to keep you safe when the bombs are
And it's also about capacity. In fairness, thoughts. Most of our foreign policy is about humanitarianism, and it's about humanitarian aid. It's about Irish aid. It's that strength. But I do understand as well that, you know, part of this is also the industry itself, the military industry and the arms industry. And that's something that we should definitely be concerned with.
I just want to turn to, dear to Clune, the idea and what we've sort of been all accepting of is the fact that our neutrality isn't exactly what all of us might define neutrality as. I mean, is it a bit of a cod, Irish neutrality?
No, I don't think it is a cod. I think military neutrality is important. But on the other hand, I think the Irish people and the majority of Irish people that Richard refers to are extremely proud of the contributions that we make in peacekeeping missions, whether they be UN mandate, EU mandate, or indeed NATO mandate, and they want that to continue. So that is going to continue. But I think against that as well, the way the world is changing, where we are situated, we actually need to do more to defend ourselves, and we need to participate in organisations and arrangements that can do that for our citizens.
Okay, well, I'm sure it's not the only discussion we're going to have on this issue in the months ahead. My thanks to today's production team of Stephen Jordan and Aidan McKelvey and Marianne Kennedy on sound. My thanks to today's panel, Deirdre Clune, Fine Gael MEP for Ireland South, Richard Boyd Barrett, People Before Profit TD for Dunleary, Seán Murray, Foreign Affairs Correspondent with the Irish Independent, and Declan Power, Security Analyst. That's all we have time for. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Between the Lines on News Talk.